Argument from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. George McCluskey will present argument for petition.
May it please the court, my name is George McCluskey and I represent Sonny Arnold Incorporated, the petitioner in this cause, and am here today arguing on behalf of all of the petitioners in this cause. This appeal, of course, is from the 7th Supreme Judicial District in Amarillo, wherein that court affirmed the judgment of the trial court, which granted a directed verdict against the petitioner, who was seeking to temporarily enjoin the respondents from selling the real property at a trustee sale. The two primary contentions before this court brought by the petitioner are as follows. That is that the respondents attempted trustee sale of the real property under the due on sale clause in the deed of trust, and the facts in this case are contended by these petitioners to be an unreasonable restraint on alienation of Sonny Arnold's fee simple ownership in the property. And secondly, we contend that all we had to show before the trial court was, in this temporary type hearing, a probable right and a probable injury, which we feel we did. Set forth in our brief before this court in our application for writ of error and brief are what we believe to be the material and controlling undisputed facts. And I won't reiterate every one of them because they are there in the brief, but let me just highlight a few of those undisputed material facts. That is that Century Savings and Loan is a Texas Savings and Loan Association doing business and headquartered in Lubbock County. That Sonny Arnold owned the property and improvements in question on November the 1st, 1979. That he was the owner and holder of a promissory note in the amount of $187,500, which was initially signed, executed in July of 1978, and there was a deed of trust securing that note, which is really the heart and the question, the clause in that deed of trust is the heart of the question in this suit. Sonny Arnold, the individual, as opposed to the corporation, also personally guaranteed that note. Now, he had made full and complete payments, and there was no dispute that all the payments had been timely made without any late charges or any problems as far as payment was concerned. But on November the 1st, 1979, he sold the property to Foxmoor, California, a limited partnership, and a Mr. Wilson, a single man. He was notified approximately 30 days later that the savings and loan had concluded that this sale was improper under their deed of trust, and then for several months they negotiated about the interest rate and whether or not there was going to be an additional payment or fee or interest rate or something like that. And then finally in May, this property was posted for a sale under a deed of trust. And I think the most pertinent part of the undisputed facts are these. When Petitioner Arnold decided to sell the property, respondent was only concerned about receiving additional fees or money in the form of interest or an interest rate escalation or some point or the like on the promissory note. And at the time of this sale, during the negotiations of this sale, and even to some extent after this sale, but prior to the time this matter got in the hands of an attorney, the only question was, how was Century Savings and Loan going to get more money on the money it had loaned? Finally, the undisputed facts are is that Petitioner Arnold would suffer a loss if the trustee sale took place. The clause in question is paragraph 19 of the deed of trust. And I won't read that to you because that's in both of the briefs, and it's also set forth in the record fully, this paragraph 19. But that type clause and this particular clause in this case has come to be called a due on sale clause, and that's what I'll refer to it as here. Some of the courts around the nation have called it other things, but I think it's generally accepted that it's referred to as a due-on-sale clause or provision. Now, approaching the initial question as to whether this clause, together with these facts, is an unreasonable restraint on alienation, I would submit to the court the following: that a deed of trust is an instrument by which a lender creates a security interest in real property as an instant of a debt. And the terms of that deed of trust usually are and should be designed to protect that security interest from either being dissipated or from disappearing altogether. I would submit that that is the logical reason for the terms and the conditions of a deed of trust, because of the nature of the deed of trust. The due on sale clause originated in the 1960s. From the research that I have done, I find that that is approximately the time that this due on sale clause came into some use, and has been used more in the 70s and on into the 80s. And it's always been, and logically should be, to protect against impairment of the lender's security. Even the Court of Civil Appeals, the Amarillo Court of Civil Appeals, stated, and I quote from their opinion, paragraph 19 is one of those provisions cast to protect the lender in the event of sale or transfer of the secured property without consent of one whose personal qualities and financial responsibility are unknown to and were not contemplated by the lender in making the loan. However, the crux of this problem, I think, is evident to everyone who's come in contact with this particular situation, is that for the last few years, lenders, such as the respondent herein, have been anxious to rid their portfolios of long-term loans at rates lower than the current prevailing rate. And I think that's the heart of the problem in this case, and probably the heart of the problem in every case where the due-on-sale clause is in conflict. In an effort to accomplish this, they've seized on this due-on-sale clause in order, from our position, to coerce the borrower either directly or from his purchaser to pay off the loan, to risk foreclosure, or to make some arrangement for the lender to gain more income or a greater rate of interest on the money loan. As in the case before the court, the lender's actions have nothing to do with protecting the debt or preserving the security of the debt. Now, prior to this case, I would submit, and I think I have some degree of comfort in doing this, I rarely say that, of course, there is no law in Texas on this particular subject, on any particular subject, because I certainly don't hold myself out in any area of the law to be that much of an expert, but from everyone's brief I can read, from the opinion of the Court of Civil Appeals, and from the amount of research that I have done, prior to this case, there was no law in Texas that I could find, or that presumably anyone else has been able to find, that has had occasion to apply the principle of the restraint on alienation argument to the due on sale clause. The closest thing that I have been able to find in this regard, and admittedly it has to do with a chattel mortgage, is the Brown versus Avimco case, which is a Ninth Circuit case in 1979 applying Texas law. And in that case, they said that they would refuse to allow such a clause to be used to gain a commercial advantage for the lender, stating that such a clause is designed to protect the creditor from actions by the debtor which jeopardize or impair the creditor's security. It should not be used offensively for commercial advantage of the creditor. The words of that court. Now, it seems logical to me that if this clause is going to be used by a lender, that there somebody should be required to prove in this type of matter that the security interest either is or is not being affected by the borrower's sale of the property. Logically, since the lender is the one who wants to protect his security interest in the property, and since he's the one who would activate the procedures under this clause, The lender should be the one to demonstrate, and it's our contention that he should be the one to demonstrate that the security interest is impaired by sale of the property before he can take the rather drastic step of acceleration of the loan and foreclosure on the real property. That, of course, was not done in this case. In fact, the facts are just the opposite. In this particular case, acceleration undisputedly was for interest only, for interest reasons only. In fact, the respondent wanted to increase the interest above the legal limit for individual borrowers at the time of this occurrence. The lender wanted to increase it to 10.5%, which an individual could not, which rate was not legal at that time under our usury laws, and therefore imposed the further restraint on Sonny Arnold Inc., the borrower seller, of requiring him to find a corporate buyer or talk a buyer into incorporating. In fact, in this particular case, they requested that the buyer be talked into incorporating, and when the buyer would not incorporate for other reasons, for their own personal reasons, whether it be tax reasons or otherwise, the sale was off. So the sale was stopped at that point. Now, as the court can see in our brief, there's certainly a divergence of opinion throughout the United States on this particular question. And we, of course, cite the cases that hold that the lender should have the burden of proof of showing that his security interest is not encumbered, or else the use of this particular clause is a restraint on alienation. We cite and talk about the Wellingkamp case out of California, then the Arizona case, Patton, the Florida case. First Federal Savings and Loan of Englewood has been recently reinforced in April of 1981 by Crestwood Apartment versus IPA, IPA Realty, 397 Southern 2nd, 366. Arkansas, Michigan, Washington, and Mississippi, and I just tell you those states because those cases are cited in my brief that apply this. Another case that I would like to mention that it seems that the law is unfolding rapidly in these other jurisdictions, and since these briefs were written advance sheets have come out showing other opinions. One state, Ohio, in the Great Northern Savings Company versus Engara, which was a Court of Civil Appeals opinion, a slip opinion CA number 9433, and it is my understanding that that opinion was not reported, but the Supreme Court affirmed that opinion. The Supreme Court of Ohio affirmed that opinion at 423 Northeast 2nd, 128. And in affirming that opinion, the opinion they affirmed used words like this, the appellate court opinion. The due on sale clause spoke of the lender's right to increase the rate of interest by 2% as an option. The lender first sought to foreclose and then decided to increase the rate of interest. The first, in our particular case, to show you how just the facts parallel here, we first got a notice that you violated our due on sale clause, and therefore we're going to activate that clause and take whatever steps we're entitled to, including foreclosure and so on and so forth under Section 27 of the Deed of Trust. Then, from November till May, they negotiated with us about a fee or a percentage or points or something in order to waive that particular clause. The trial court in this Ohio case said a contract is a contract, and you're bound by the terms of your contract. The appellate court, which was affirmed, said the lender should not be allowed to enforce a due on sale clause without a sufficient showing of a real threat to its recognized, legitimate, and justifiable interest in the subject property. Such would be an unreasonable restraint on alienation. This clause, it says, is a direct restraint. And it cited the Tucker case throughout the opinion as authority for that proposition. Now, there's no question but that in Texas, acceleration clauses has historically been considered very harsh and been scrutinized very carefully. And this, of course, is the remedy pursued by the lender herein. They're doing it, in our view, strictly to seek economic gain, not to protect their security interests. The fee simple owner of the property, under Texas law, has an unlimited right and power of alienation. The only logical impediment at all on that unlimited right, or limitation at all, is that in alienating that property, he not in any way encumber or decrease the security. The undisputed evidence is that Arnold was the fee simple owner of this property, and that he sailed to Foxmoor only concerned these respondents because they couldn't get more return on their money. They didn't indicate at the time that they had any concern about their security interests. The one interesting aspect of the Court of Civil Appeals that I might just mention to the court is when they talked about this conveyance, in their opinion, from Arnold to Foxmoor, they talked in terms that the conveyance was not prohibited, the conveyance was not prevented, the conveyance was not caused to be void. As I look at those words that the Court of Civil Appeals used, the interpretation of prohibited means to me to forbid or to stop or to prevent. On the other hand, the word restraint means to check or repress or suppress or to curb or to limit or to restrict or to impede. This case, I submit to the court, concerns impeding or limiting or curbing or suppressing the marketability of the property. It talks about restraint on alienation, not prohibition of alienation. It's not a prohibition. Therefore, the due on sale clause, as used by the respondents herein and under these undisputed facts, involved a restraint on alienation, and the injunctive relief prayed for should have been granted. We submit to the court that the law in Texas should be that the due on sale clause in a deed of trust is an unreasonable restraint of alienation of property unless the lender can demonstrate enforcement is necessary to protect against impairment of the secured real property. In this case, as an example, you have a $350,000 piece of property, market value for that property, versus a $187,500 note. Still, you have the same borrower on the note, you have the same guarantor on the note, you even have an additional entity paying in money so that this note can be paid off. All payments have been timely made, and there has been no problem with the management of the property. We therefore suggest to the court that a device that grants a lender an opportunity to vary the interest rate on a loan at the time of a subsequent sale benefits only the private interest of the lender and in no way promotes the free market flow of the property. It is an unreasonable restraint against alienation. Finally, the second point, that contention that we bring before this court, is that at the time the case was tried, it was on the basis of a temporary injunction hearing. As stated earlier, we understand the law to be in Texas that in these types of hearing, all you have to show is a probable right and a probable injury to prevail.
We have a different test the last few years for temporary injunction and probable right. Are you familiar with that?
Well, Your Honor, I understood that was the test.
Well, so not exactly that now. I think
yeah, is Your Honor referring to whether or not the trial court abused its discretion?
In preserving the status quo, right.
Yes, sir, and I understood the law
again,
to be.
Again, Paul Timbers against somebody.
Beg your pardon?
I say the new test had its origin in part in a case called Tall Timbers.
Well, I apologize to the court if I'm approaching this on the wrong basis, but I understood that the I understood that that's what the appellate court looked at, is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion. But I understood also that the further matter that the trial court was to look at is whether or not there was a probable right and a probable injury. If that is not the case, I apologize to the court for
it doesn't particularly matter.
for stating the law incorrectly. But I would say, if I am correct in the law, Your Honor, that under the undisputed facts and the lack of Texas law on this question and the various holdings from other jurisdictions, that this petitioner did show a probable right. And also he showed a probable injury. And therefore, the trial court did abuse its discretion, so our convicted verdict, and the Court of Civil Appeals should have reversed that holding, because the Court of Civil Appeals is really saying is that as a matter of law, this is a right, and therefore it would be impossible for us to prove that we had a probable, that we should prevail, and that's really not our burden of proof. With deference to the court, I would suggest that our burden of proof is a probable right at the time of the temporary injunction hearing.
Would there be a difference in the test when a temporary injunction is granted and when one is denied? If one is granted, I think it's clear that we look at whether or not the trial court abuses discretion in preserving the status quo. When one is denied, though, are you suggesting that we test that denial by probable right, probable injury?
Yes, sir, I am. And
in determining abuse?
Yes, sir, and I would again say to the court that if I'm misquoting the law, I do apologize, but I believe that the test is the same, that the probable injury and probable right test is the same in either case. And I, as the court may appreciate...
Excuse me, Ms. Cowan, didn't you write the case and state this rule, the temporary injunction rule?
As the court may appreciate, I've been much more concerned with the initial question, and that is the restraint on alienation question, and briefed this other one at the time of the trial and at the time of the Court of Civil Appeals hearing. But I do believe that it is our contention that that's still the test, whether it's granted or denied.
What's the current status of the property? Was it foreclosed on?
No, sir. What happened at the Court of Civil Appeals is what we got was an injunction from that court for it to preserve its jurisdiction during the time of the hearing. And then the respondent has not sought to foreclose pending this appeal. So the status quo is being maintained until this court can rule on this matter. We therefore submit that the opinion of the Court of Civil Appeals should be reversed, and that an injunction enjoining the respondents from selling the property at trustee sale should be rendered, or in the alternative, it should be reversed and remanded with these type of instructions to the Court of Civil Appeals, or reversed and remanded for a further hearing on the temporary injunction with some guidelines from the court as to possible burden of proof and other matters. Yes, sir.
My problem with these view-on-sale clauses is, as I recall them, they started off in about 63, 64, 65 in that area, period. The first clause is, that I can recall, just had some language to the effect that the savings and loan would have the right to approve the credit of any purchase, and if they found the credit to be unworthy, then they could foreclose. Then as interest rates went up, the clauses became more sophisticated, and some of them in the last 3 or 4 years have just had clauses to the effect that any sale would accelerate the maturity. And this one is just a little bit different. Do you think that if in a decision in this case would apply to most all of those clauses, do you think that that the language of the clause itself would have any bearing, in other words, the intent of the parties as expressed in the language of deed of trust, or is any alienation, restriction on alienation against public policy?
All right, I believe that, let me first say that any unreasonable restraint on alienation should be held to be invalid, and I think the type that in these deeds of trust, I think the thrust of a deed of trust is to protect that security interest, and the clauses in there should be designed to do that, from decreasing in value or from being dissipated altogether. And any clause that does not do that is a restraint on alienation, to the extent, if nothing else, it's a restraint on the marketability of that property. And therefore, I think that aspect of it requires the lender, or should require the lender, to come in and prove that in some way he's foreclosing or he's activating that clause because his security interest is being encumbered. Now, if he feels like that's going to happen, then it's not, he ought to have that right to it. He ought to have that right to protect his security interest. But I don't think that he ought to just say, well, I want to help my portfolio of loans here. I want to increase the money that I'm making, and therefore I'm going to use this as an offensive weapon to do that. And we contend that's what's happening in this case.
In other words, you're contending that they ought to just make a variable rate loan to start with, set it out in a note rather than go to the deed of trust with a due on sale clause.
Well, as your Honor's probably aware, that's what they're beginning to do, as I understand it. They're making short rate variable interest loans and rollover loans and things like that, where everybody, you know, knows going in at a certain time it's gonna increase. 3 years it's gonna increase, or it's gonna be tied to some factor that's going up and down. And the key to that is that it's not activated by a man trying to sell his property. We contend that the crux of the problem lays in the man trying to sell his property, and the threat of what they're fixing to do under this clause is the evil.
Well, as a practical matter, counsel, and it's probably true that most of these loans are old enough and they've got enough equity in them that they've got to refinance them anyway.
They may, Your Honor, but in this particular one, it was 1 year old. And I submit that there are others, and I also submit that the lending institutions certainly don't pick and choose among the loans. If the law is held to be that that's not a restraint on alienation, they can do it across the board, whatever happens. And I would suggest to you that the lending institutions are in an economic crunch, there's no doubt about it, but they are trying to rehabilitate themselves and doing a good job of it in these new type loans that they're making, and they shouldn't be putting the burden on people who have already signed notes and deeds of trust to act to impair and to restrain their sale by activating this type of clause.
Can people contract to do that? If I read this deal and sale clause, it says specifically says last in the subparagraph B that the lender may require in the event of a sale an increase in the rate of interest.
In this particular clause, it does talk about an increase in the interest rate, but it is our contention that the fact that that's in there really begs the question, because the due on sale clause that mentions this possible. This is really a typical due on sales clause, and if you read all of these provisions, it appears that what the lender is really trying to do is protect his security interest. Now, in B, the last part of the B section, it talks about this increased interest rate. And we submit that if it's used by the lender, either because it's in there or not in there, it's still a question as to whether or not this is a proper or reasonable restraint on alienation. And there's three courts in the United States that have hit this head on. Should I continue to answer that question? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, counsel. Your argument to respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Charles Gailey, present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, as the marshal says, my name is Charles Gailey, Mr. McCleskey. If I understand the argument made by petitioner in this case, it is that this court should overlook the terms of a contract made between the parties. The contract specifically states in the clause at issue that the lender may increase the rate of interest. I think then it is important that I discuss just briefly with the court what this clause says and what it does not say. Mr. Arnold was a sophisticated investor. He's a developer in Lubbock. He had built, during the years about when this loan was made, many homes and many commercial properties there in Lubbock and had executed any number of deeds of trust. He knew what the provisions of a deed of trust was. He knew what a deed of trust was.
Well, counsel, does it make any difference if the borrower is a little old lady in tennis shoes? Is the law any different?
No, sir. But I'm talking about this case.
Well, we're talking about all cases,
yes,
too.
No, sir, I do not think it makes any difference in that regard. It would be much more difficult for a trial court, perhaps, under those facts to decide
well,
a case. Hard cases make bad law, I believe.
Yeah, it's the same rule is going to apply to everybody.
Yes, sir. That would be my intention and my belief. But the reason I mentioned those facts in this case is going to lead into development that what the petitioner is trying to do is profit at the expense of the savings and loan in this particular case. His argument is that he should be able to ignore this contract. Now, the reason he wants to do that under the facts of the case is that he went out and sold the property for $345,000. He at first went out to Century Savings and discussed with them the fact that he might like to sell this property, and they talked about an increase in interest. So he didn't go back to them after that discussion, and he went ahead and sold the property to an out-of-state buyer. And he did it with what's commonly known as a wraparound deed of trust mortgage. Now, he wrapped around Century's $187,500 loan, and by doing that, and didn't tell him about it. Neither he nor the buyer told him about it. And then he was able then to use that low interest rate loan of 9.75% to increase the value of the property. He was able to make a quarter of a point interest by wrapping around because his note was at 10%. Then he was able to get the increased inflation value of the property at the dollar rate.
Counsel, you said he attempted to profit at the savings and loan expense?
Yes, sir.
Did it cost the savings and loan any more money as
yes,
a result of this selling? Mm-hmm.
Well, it did by him not paying off the loan. Now, here's another way it's going to cost the
what
money.
What I'm getting at is that in the exchange of the property between Arnold and the California folks,
yes, sir.
Did the savings and loan have to pay out any more money, or did they lose any money as a result of that transaction?
No additional money came out of their pocket.
But what you're saying is that they lost money by virtue of the fact that they couldn't increase the interest.
Yes,
they didn't
sir.
Have to go out and borrow any more money. The money was already borrowed. The money was already put out on the property. It was already loaned out.
Oh, that would be correct.
So in the increasing market, they didn't have to go out and borrow some more money. They'd already borrowed it at an interest rate and loaned it based on that interest rate.
Well, yes, sir, except the money they used to fund that loan is short-term money. It's depositors that put it in there and it's turning over. So the cost of their money is constantly going up. And by the time this loan is assumed, their cost of money could easily have gone from 8%, 7%, to 10%, 11%. And the facts of this case illustrate that. Mr. Arnold admitted it. So when he sold this property, he had certificates of deposit on deposit that was making 12 to 13%. So Century's cost of money was going up by virtue of its turnover. True, they didn't pay out any additional money, but the money that they had out by virtue of the turnover, this same $187,500 had turned over, and its cost on that was going up. Now, Mr. Arnold profited in another way. He's got a 7-year note. When he wrapped around Century, which is a 15-year note with a blunt. When he wrapped around Century's note,
what
he took...
What do you mean by wrapped around?
Sir?
What do you mean by wrapped around?
I mean that when Mr. Arnold sold the property to the California group, that he took a note back for $266,000. Included in that $266,000 is the original $187,500 that Century had loaned. The payments were coming from the California group to Arnold, and then he was taking that payment and then going ahead and continuing to make the payment to Century Savings Association. So the California group executed, well, in a typical maybe house transaction, you might give us, let's say you were paying $266,000 for a piece of property and you assume the $187,500, then you'd give a second lien for the difference. They didn't do it that way in this case. They took the full note for the $266,000 and that included the underlying note to Century.
They really just left the original note undisturbed.
Yes, sir. Now, in the deed from Mr. Arnold to Mr. Gambler, he agreed to indemnify, Foxmore it is, he agreed to indemnify them against the any action that Century might take in the case, which the significance of that clause is that all the parties knew going into this transaction, both the buyer and the seller, that the clause was in the deed of trust and what could well happen. Now the other thing, as I was about to go forward, on the cost of money to Century, is that in 7 years, when Arnold gets his $266,000, it has got $266,000 in cash. It still owes Century the unpaid balance of the original $187,500. Now, on a 30-year amortization loan, that's going to be paid now, and I haven't calculated, but let's say $150,000. Century has got cash in his pocket of the full sales price, and Century has still got the $187,000 loan outstanding in 7 years, and he's not going to pay it off by all logical business principles, because he's going to take that same $187,500 and go buy a certificate of deposit, Century Savings, and let's say at current rates, 15-16%, just let them draw their payment out of that.
Counsel, what you're really arguing to us, it sounds like, is who owns this property and who's entitled to make the money on it? Is it the fellow who has the deed to it, or is it the people who are lending? And if the market changes, who's entitled to the advantages? Who owns the property?
Well,
you're really making a policy argument to us that the lending agency is the one who ought to get the money if there's an increase in value.
Well, I understand the observation that you're making. That is, in a sense, a policy argument, but it also involves a legal question. And now, there's a case that has been decided since we wrote the briefs, and this is Williams versus First Federal Savings and Loan by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in 651 Federal Second at page 910. And the court in that case addresses the very issue that that the comment was just made about. Now the comment, this case discusses it in very detailed language and comes to the conclusion that a borrower with a loan that's of low interest is in a better position than a person who owns his home outright and free of debt, because that borrower with the low interest rate loan then is able to go sell the property with a higher return. So the low interest rate loan discounted is makes the property worth more money. And in this case that we have here vividly illustrates that because of the 9.75% loan.
It fascinates me the evolution of these mortgages. There was a time when the market was such that lending agencies would put into their contracts a prohibition against paying at all. Buy a home, there's a clause in there that prohibits you from paying at all because they want to protect that interest. Now we add not only to that clause, but this other one that prohibits you from selling it. So now the fellow who owns the property can neither buy it nor sell it. So who owns the property?
I'd say that Mr. Arnold did at one time own the property. He sold it. Foxmoor now owns the property. My observation in that respect is that, first of all, Century Savings made a loan to Sonny Arnold. He's the borrower. He's the person they looked through the paper. They made it on a commercial piece of property. And they said, and Mr. Arnold readily agreed, that if I sell it, they don't restrict him from selling it. He can go sell it. He did. And he said, but he said, if I sell it, then we've got certain options that you have under the terms of the deed of trust.
Was there a prepayment penalty in this deed of trust offer?
Well, there's nothing in the record that indicates that. But I'll tell the court, and I think Mr. McCleskey would be glad for me to do this, outside of the record, that there was a small prepayment penalty for the first 5 years. After
so,
that, it's...
So the savings loan was getting a penalty for prepayment and also a bonus in case of sale?
No, sir.
Well, they got an increase in interest in that.
Well, no. Excuse me.
If they get an increase in the interest rate from the new lender in that new borrower, in that, in effect, a bonus?
Well, they wouldn't be getting both, though. They wouldn't be getting both a prepayment penalty and an escalation in interest.
They'd be getting the prepayment penalty from the seller, and they'd be getting the bonus from the buyer,
well,
not from the same person.
But there wouldn't be a prepayment if they had allowed an assumption, so there wouldn't be a prepayment penalty.
But you're saying they shouldn't have to allow an assumption. They should have to pay it off or refinance it.
Well, they their option is to allow an assumption under the terms of the deed of trust. That's the option they have to. And then if they accelerate the note, then they could demand that it be paid off.
Do you know of any situations today where they allow assumptions in the rising interest rate market? They just, practical matter, don't do it. This is Century here. It's not allowed. They're wanting the higher interest rate.
Well, I think it would be if they wouldn't want the higher interest rate.
Let me ask you, I'm still not clear on the question I asked you before. You said, well, the cost of money is going up for the savings and loan. Therefore, it is an expense to them in that sense. When Sonny Arnold bought the property, he borrowed, $187,000?
Yes, sir.
Now, the Century wrote a check for that to somebody, from whoever Sonny Arnold bought it from, didn't he?
No, sir. It was an independent transaction. It was not a third party of Endorse Lending.
Well, what I'm getting at in a normal situation is, though, that the savings and loan will pay out to the seller on behalf of the borrower and get a first lien to protect the note that he gets from the buyer. So that money's gone. That money has been borrowed at a rate and has been paid out and loaned out at a rate. So if you're allowed to increase that money, the interest rate on that money, it's just a bonus. It just increases the profit margin.
The problem with that was it was temporary money, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. It's short term.
Well, how can you, if it's temporary money, how can you pay it out over a long term basis?
Well, you just got to keep hustling depositors and hoping that they keep depositing money in your savings loan. They also have the opportunity to borrow from the Federal Home Loan Bank to cover loans, but that's at an interest rate that might be non-competitive also.
Well, what happens is you take the depositor's money and you pay off the contractor. Let's say it's $200,000, and you have that money borrowed at 6% from the depositor. Well, when their CDs come up for renewal, you have to pay them an additional interest rate, which means that the money that you owe them is going up all the time, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's how they get, how savings loans get hurt in rising market.
It might not be the original $187,500 that they used to fund that loan, but they've had to take that $187,500 that the depositor brought in and replace it with another $187,500.
I understand.
And in return, you loan that out at the current interest rate. That's how it's supposed to operate anyway, isn't it?
Well, it's the, we've got to keep that $187,500 covered at all times, though. We can't use multiples to gerrymander that into additional sum. I'd like to comment in that regard on the variable interest rate loan about Mr. McCleskey was asked about. The question was, is will this convert, if the due on sale clause is not enforced, will they start writing variable interest rate loans? Perhaps not. I don't know what the lenders are going to decide about that. I know that in the industry that there are variable interest rate notes, but what the difference is on a variable interest rate loan, if I am the borrower, that means that my payments are changing from time to time. And I don't know of any cases that would hold that a loan of that nature is illegal. If I go out and contract, if in 1 year I'll increase my rate from 7% to 8%, and it varies according to some index. If I were a...
Is there a difference between setting out all these terms in your note and putting it over in the deed of trust on the due on sale clause?
I think that under the Texas law that the terms of the transaction are considered as a whole. The note and deed of trust are considered in the transaction as a whole, and the court looks to all for the documents as a whole. The note in this case is not before the court. It's not put into evidence. But on a due on sale clause, the borrower has an advantage in that he's got a level payment. Now the only thing the borrower, the homeowner, the apartment house owner has to do, if he sells it, then he looks at the clause and the buyer might have an interest rate escalation plan. Perhaps some people would rather do it that way and they own the home for the full 30 years and pay off the loan, they've had a constant payment. They might perhaps rather do that than have a variable rate. A due on sale clause would allow that to happen. Without the due on sale clause, the lenders then maybe necessarily have to go to a variable rate mortgage or rollover mortgages or numerous other types of mortgages that have evolved.
Sounds like there even some contracts now where the lender will let you have the money at a favorable rate, let's say 11%, but if you sell the property within 10 years, split the profit with the lender.
I personally have not seen a loan of that nature, particularly on a residence. There are equity participation loans in the commercial area that I'm familiar with, but I have not seen a loan of that nature on splitting the profit. I've read something about it, but I personally have not done a loan of that kind.
Counsel, you made excellent policy arguments. As I understand it, we're talking about the old common law restraint on alienation rule.
Yes, sir.
What does it say?
Well, as Justice Reynolds said in the lower court, we've got three kinds of restraints. I thought when I was in law school I'd never hear about restraint against alienation again, and if I'd have known I was going to have a case of this nature, I would have listened to Professor Emery a lot better. But I have gone and tried to read the restatement of property. There's three kinds of restraints that we're talking about here, I think that if you read the restatement and look at it carefully, that we find that the clause involved in this case just actually does not fit and cannot be a restraint. Petitioner is not arguing that it's a restraint. He wants to talk reasonable restraint or unreasonable restraint, as I heard his argument that he made at the court. But the three restraints, which one is an attempt by conveyance or contract to cause a later conveyance to be void. That's labeled as a disabling restraint. There's nothing in this clause, and no court that I have seen has ever labeled a due on sale clause as being a disabling restraint. There's a forfeiture restraint which covers a future interest. It's not involved here. So the only possible clause that could be pertinent to this case is what is called a promissory restraint, and that is impose contractual liability on the one who makes the later conveyance when such liability results from a breach of an agreement not to convey. Results from a breach of an agreement not to convey. There is no agreement not to convey in our case. It's just not in that clause.
Well, counsel, can you make an agreement that is so onerous that in fact you can't convey? And is that the issue that will ultimately be determined? That it's a restraint on trade if, in this instance, the restraint is one which prohibits the grantee and the deed from making a sale. He can't pay it off. He can't pay it off and pay the lender off. There's a provision in the contract which prohibits him from doing that. So he can either sell it to pay it off, and he can't buy it. He can mow the grass and pay the taxes.
Well, the borrower in this case had the option to pay it off. Now, he might not have had the money to do it.
I'm talking about this. In this case, maybe it did. But if we have both of these provisions in the same deed of trust, and I'm sure we will, already do probably, where you can't pay it off in advance, and if you sell it, then you have this clause in it that we're talking about.
On the prepayment penalty clause, this adverse to due on sale clause is what I understand the court to be talking about.
Well, I've got a mortgage that doesn't give me a prepayment penalty. It says I can't pay it off.
Well, I'm not familiar with the mortgage. That certainly was not in this one. It's not in this case, and I have not seen a mortgage that says you can't pay a loan off.
Of course, it's 6.5%. I'm willing to abide.
I think also, Justice Polk, that the savings and loan would waive that provision if you take
I'm
the
sure
money.
I'm sure they would.
So
I made a contract, and I'm going to abide.
Yeah. And that's what Sonny Arnold did here. Sonny Arnold made a contract, and all we're asking is that he abide by it. And that's just exactly the issue in this case.
Up to this point, neither one of you have mentioned the federal law, although a number of the amicus do. Explain to me, does federal law permit this type of contract? And has there been a case on restraint on alienation in that, or what is the effect?
Yes, sir. The federal law, and I believe we mentioned it in our response, the petitioner is relying on a Wellenkamp case out of California, which requires that you show the lender show impairment of security. The federal regulations have provisions in them that a due on sale clause is permissible, and the federal courts in California and in other areas of the United States have held that those federal regulations as to a federal savings loan association preempt the state law. Specifically hold that as to federal associations in California, the Wellenkamp case does not apply. That makes this Williams case that I just cited to the court all the more interesting because it, from the Fourth Circuit, because it cites and discusses the federal preemption cases.
Well, has that ever been challenged as restraint on alienation?
In this case,
federal law.
Yes, sir. This, if I understand the question, this Williams case talks about it, and in very forceful terms said we don't even have to get to the federal preemption doctrine because this clause is absolutely not a restraint on alienation. And they talk about the Wellenkamp case and discuss it in great detail, and forcefully disagree with the Wellenkamp case, and that, I think that's a very strong position that the federal courts have taken. They have gone federal preemption. This is the first case where I've said we don't even have to get to that. It just absolutely is not a restraint on alienation. Now, this case involved both a federal association and a state association. Had consolidated cases in the Fourth Circuit. There's one thing I would like to mention concerning policy, perhaps, but I think it also pertains to the law. The state of Texas, the legislature of this state, has recognized that due on sale clauses are valid. One of the amicus briefs, I believe Professor Woodward, mentions the Texas Veteran Land Board statute, where the Veteran Land Board goes out and buys land and sells it on contract to veterans. That statute prohibits the veteran from selling the property within 3 years. There's also another statute. It was recodified in this session, just finished, of the Texas Legislature in agriculture.
What's the relevance of that?
Sir?
I don't see the relevance of that.
As I see it, Your Honor.
In other words, the legislature certainly could provide loans to veterans and be sure they're loans to veterans, not that the veteran's going to buy the land and sell it to some realty company. That's a different problem.
That is, but the agricultural code is not. The agricultural
code, then.
Sir?
That's okay. Let's go to the agricultural code.
It's a recodification of the old Article 55, 55G of the Vernon statute. That allows a commissioner of agriculture to guarantee loans for farm and family home farm and ranch security loans, I believe is what it's entitled, up to 90%. The lenders then go out and make a deed of trust. That act provides that a borrower who sells or conveys the property for which a family farm and ranch security loan was issued shall immediately retire the debt. A family farm and ranch loan may not be assumed by new owner. Now, if I understand the restraint on alienation doctrine, it's a question of policy itself. It's a question of policy. Policy has been established by the legislature in this act as to doing that. So this means if a savings and loan makes a loan under this agricultural code, which it's authorized to do, it then has in its portfolio a mortgage in which it can exercise and must exercise the deal on sale clause. Whereas we have another loan over here, if this court were to say that our clause in this case is invalid, well, we'd have another loan that we couldn't exercise. So we have a federal preemption doctrine that applies to federals, it doesn't apply to us. We have some loans in which it does apply and which it does not apply. I yield to the opinions in the Nebraska Supreme Court case, the Occidental Savings case, and in the federal case that I just cited to the court for my argument. I adopt those cases in their entirety and think that I just couldn't make a better argument than they do. The Brown versus Avemco case that Mr. McCleskey referred to, I'd like to comment on in my closing. That's a California case that's contrary to the Clark investment case that has previously been decided by this court and is cited in our brief. The Brown versus Avemco case uses dicta language, but it involves a foreclosure on an airplane. It involves a surreptitious foreclosure, a repossession by the lender when the loan had been paid, all in the full amount had been tendered. But if the case simply boils down to the inequitable conduct on the part of the lender, which the Court of Civil Appeals in our case recognizes is still a defense to the note. I have no quarrel with that. There's a strong line of cases that if the acceleration of maturity is brought about by the inequitable or fraudulent conduct on behalf of the lender, then that's a defense to acceleration. I have no quarrel with that. There's no contention of that in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal argument from petitioner.
I believe that Mr. Gailey has correctly stated to the court, and I believe that the court would concur that this restraint on alienation is a policy decision, has been treated as such, and should be treated as such. And I would like to answer
counsel,
some...
policies for the legislature, ordinarily, you've got to leave. You have to hang your hat on some rule of law that says this is an invalid clause?
Yes, sir. And that is the restraint on alienation.
I've been waiting for somebody to tell me about that.
All right. Maybe I should ask the court what he wants to know about it. That's what I thought I'd been talking about.
I had to even ask where it came from, and I was told it's a restatement of property now.
Yes, sir. If I may, maybe it would clear up a matter if I spoke to the restatement of property provision 404.
Yeah, we begin, I presume, with the fact that persons can make contracts which will be enforced. Unless what?
Unless it is against public policy to restrain alienation in this particular case. To restrain, unless you have a restraint against the alienation of a fee simple owner's property right.
Well, now, what public policy do we have that says that? Has the legislature passed anything?
No, sir. We do not have anything from our legislature on real estate, on chattel. On personal property matters.
If we don't have anything setting the policy, then why can't these folks just contract any way they want to contract?
Because I think that the court should look at the public interest of whether or not real estate ought to be...
function, isn't it?
Big pardon?
That's the legislature function, isn't it?
Well, sir,
There's not a rule of law existent that is not based upon some sort of public policy. And an elementary reading of Cardoza and Holmes and every other legal scholar will tell you that. There's no rule of law that you just pick out of the air. It's not handed down from the mountain like Moses got the Ten Commandments. It's based upon some public policy of public mores or tradition or custom or common sense or something else that falls within the purview of public policy. The legislature's not the only one that hands down policy. It would be naive to say that. Every ruling this court makes is based upon some sort of public policy.
I feel that's right, and the higher up in the appellate process you go, the more you get to that stage. I might say this, that as far as Section 404 of the restatement is concerned, the Court of Civil Appeals dealt with the proposition that under Section 404, this laundry list, which was adopted in 1944, that we just don't fall under that type of a restraint. This clause just doesn't do that. However, I would suggest to the court that in 58 Iowa Law Review 747, a very exhaustive and maybe one of the most exhaustive analyses of this question, it states, although written as an acceleration clause, the due-on-sale clause directly and fundamentally burdens a mortgagor's ability to alienate as surely and directly as the classical promissory restraint. As such, the due-on-sale clause is truly a direct restraint insofar as the category of direct restraints can be articulated. As the Austin Court of Civil Appeals wrestled with this in this Crestview case, which is currently before this court on an application for writ of error, it said, the definition and rules of the restatement of property are of little help in ascertaining whether the due-on-sale clause is in law an impermissible restraint on alienation of real property. The pertinent provisions do not clearly fit the situation where such a clause is attacked on the basis of its inhibiting effect against sales. And another writer in the Law of Future Interest, Symes and Smith, stated, and as a practical matter, it is a restraint. He said, any provision in the deed, will, contract, or other legal instrument which would tend to impair the marketability of the property is a restraint on alienation. And I suggest to the court that that's what we have here in this due on sale clause. I would speak to also another aspect of Mr. Gailey's statement to the court and just in passing, and that is that, as he did suggest, there was a prepayment penalty. The prepayment penalty in this case was 5%. It decreased over a five-year period, 1% each year. So at the time of this sale, it was 4%. So Judge Pope has suggested the borrower seller is stopped on either end from getting out without some type of a penalty. Also, as to the question of the federal law. Let me speak to that briefly, because that has also been a question which I think initially came up or the attack was mounted, maybe because the California court was kind of the lead court in this area, in California, stating that the federal law, the Federal Home Loan Bank regulations preempted state law. That has been met head on in three different states. In the case cited in our brief in Florida, First Federal Savings and Loan of Englewood versus Lockwood, they met that head on and said, no, the federal law does not preempt state law in this area. In California, in June of 1981, in PANKO, P-A-N-K-O versus Pan American Federal Savings and Loan, at 174 California Reporter 240, it met it head on there too and said, no, federal law does not preempt state law in this area. And again, in the the Minnesota Supreme Court in April of 81 in Holiday Acres number 3 versus Midwest Federal Savings and Loan of Minneapolis, 308 Northwest 2nd, 471. It said that this property law question is a matter traditionally for state interest, and mere federal permission allowing this to happen does not mean federal preemption. So three courts have hit it straight on. I will admit to the court that there is a federal district court in Florida, Northern District of Florida, which has said yes, it does, which does not surprise me that the federal court would take that position on a federal regulation. But three states have said no, federal law does not preempt that. I don't think that's really material in this case directly, because we're not dealing with a federal savings and loan. It's material only to the extent of Mr. Gaddy's argument that the state savings and loans will be put at a disadvantage. The other area that I would like to respond to is that as far as this question, which was initially brought up in Mr. Gailey's argument about a profit being made, and the fact that he said we did not, the facts will show that we didn't tell them what was going on, I submit to the court that a reading of the statement of facts will show that undisputedly we advised the savings and loan all along what was going on, and as a matter of fact, their senior loan officer suggested this type of procedure that was used, this wraparound type procedure. And as a matter of fact, this wraparound procedure itself shows no impairment to the note, because the same entity is on the note, the same guarantor is on the note, and there's no impairment to the property that was shown. The same note and the same deed of trust with the same borrower and the same lender still exist. The problem, and I would stress this again, is that the savings and loan not only wanted more interest, but they wanted an interest rate that cut off individual buyers. They wanted 10 1/4, and 10 1/4 was an illegal, was a usurious interest rate at that time to individual borrowers, so they said, you're going to have to get you a corporate borrower, another impediment to the sale of this property. I would suggest to the court that savings and loans have the ability to make economic decisions, and they do that when they loan the public money. When they set that interest rate, they make long-term economic projections. That's what they set that interest rate on. And because they were wrong in their projections of what the economy is going to do and what interest rates are going to do, they should not burden the public, the borrowing public, the people that have borrowed money from them, by saying we're going to use this due on sale clause and activate it and stop you as a practical matter from selling your property.
Well, counsel, what will happen economically to savings and loan associations if we say this is an undue restraint on alienation?
Your Honor, as I stated earlier, I think that the savings and loan associations are making adjustments at this time. I'm not so sure that they ought to be able to use the courts in order to help one industry over the borrowing public. And I think that's the situation we're getting into. I think they're already making those adjustments. I don't think they ought to be able to come in here and restrain the free marketability of property just so they can adjust their portfolio in this economic situation.
Well, of course, if they all go broke, that's not going to help the public either, is it?
Well, it's sure not going to help the public who owns stock in savings and loans. And I think that's the public, that's the portion of the public that's most concerned at this stage, and whom I see all these amicus curiae briefs.
Did you have some additional authority, either of you, that are not in your briefs?
Your Honor, I have cited some in this argument because this thing is unfolded. How should we submit?
Would you please put both of you, if you have any recent citations, put them in a letter form to the clerk to be distributed to us?
Yes. Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted on written briefs and the oral argument for both parties. The court will take a brief recess.
Go ahead, please, Brian.